Hey everyone, thanks for checking out the Wait What If podcast. I am your host, Kevin Sullivan, and I am 100% healthy, and that is awesome because I have gone, well, you heard me on the last episode that came out 2 weeks ago. I was just getting over being just ridiculously sick for like a month and a half, but finally, I'm better. I think it's because I went keto. I've read about it. I've always wanted to go into ketosis, and I heard lots of good things about it, and I just never... It's hard. It's not an easy thing to do, and it can be unpleasant, I guess, when you first start doing it. But I've always been into intermittent fasting and all that stuff, so I figured it'd be an easy transition. And me and my wife have been, we did the Mark Sisson 21-day keto reset, where it's strictly dietary, and I still add intermittent fasting in there. This is all boring stuff, and I'm sure you're fascinated. But the whole point is I'm trying to boost up my immune system, because every single day that I'm at work, I am just assaulted with viruses, and it just kicked my ass this year, and I'm not going to let it do that anymore because I hate being sick. So yeah, we are going to be going live again on December 11th, just like we did on the Halloween episode, but this is going to be a Christmas episode. I've been trying to do a solid Christmas episode now. This is our third or fourth year in a row, and I just haven't been able to get one out, but this year we're going to do it. We're going to do it live. It's going to be, like I said, December 11th, 8:30 p.m. Eastern time. We're going to broadcast from Revival 1869. I'm going to try some new things. I have some new equipment that we're going to work on. Should be fun. So check it out. It'll be on Facebook / WWI podcast. I'll tweet it out at WWI podcast, or just go to waitwhatif.com, and hopefully I'll have some links and all that stuff up there. Tonight's guest is with Sean Michael Hayes. He is a professional skateboarder, traveler, writer, poet, philosopher. He's got some interesting stories, interesting ideas on life. You know, he went through some hard times, made the best of them, and he's successful at what he does now. So that's about it. I can't think of anything else to talk about, which is weird because I love to just run my freaking mouth, but I guess that's it. So enjoy the show.
You're listening to the Wait What If podcast.
All right, so I've already done an intro and everything, but typically my intros are quick, and it's really meant to kind of give the listeners what's going on, and then really for my advertisers. So I kind of let you do a quick background. Now, I don't know where to start with you. As a skate coach or as a author?
I mean, or how about just as a Canadian?
Okay. Yeah. You know what's funny?
Vancouver, Canada. Is an awesome place to come from.
I've honestly had two dozen interviews with Canadians. I don't know why. I don't know if it's just because you guys like to chat, or my last interview actually was with a Canadian, and then you, and then I've had a bunch with you folks.
I've heard one of them with another Canadian guy from Alberta.
Was he the ayahuasca guy?
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, he's a really cool dude. Actually, he just went on a trip to Peru.
Right. That's what he was like leading up to that, was what he was talking about.
Yeah, which is good that you remind me, because I got to get him back on. I want to find out how his actual jungle experience went compared to his northern woodsy adventure went. But we'll definitely talk about that, because I was just thumbing through your bio, and I saw that there was some info on that. So
Canadians, we love to talk.
Yeah.
You know?
Like to drink some beer. I mean, it's cold, right? So everyone just kind of, it's like in your genes to just kind of sit around a fire and
it is a lot of the times of the year. What's amazing is this time of the year.
Yeah.
So specifically end of summer it's everyone's happy. It's sunny out, you know?
Yeah.
As good as it gets.
Do you guys get depressed? Like when I worked, I work in medicine. I was up in upstate New York for a year, and I had a lot of seasonally depressed people.
Totally.
Do you guys deal with that up there? Is that like a major thing, or?
Well, I mean, for me personally, like I like to leave the cold elements in the winter because they affect me, and I think that they probably affect a lot of people, but on the other hand, they also toughen a lot of people up. Give them something to sort of like an antagonism in their life that they can fight against that isn't like, you know, like, oh, I got to get out and shovel the driveway, clean my house up and stuff, you know, but it gives purpose, I guess, for some people.
Isn't the majority of the population of Canada, though, isn't it all along the southern border there?
A lot of it, yeah. I mean, and in the big cities, for sure. I mean, so much of it's unpopulated and just big forests.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, definitely the more south, just it's a little bit warmer. I think once you start getting up sort of above halfway up Canada, it gets real cold in the winter.
It's
also beautiful, yeah.
There's a video on, I don't know what site it's on, but it's Gavin McGinnis. He talks about all the celebrities that wanted to move after Trump got elected, everyone that was saying they live to Canada. So he had a big Canadian map up, and he goes through and he's like, well, if you want to move to Canada, and he goes through all the places that you could possibly move, and it really just came down to like 5 square miles of Toronto, which was like the only place that Americans would be comfortable moving to. It was kind of good. Check it out.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. Or I like the one about when someone made a joke, like after Trump had won too, and they're like, okay, so all you celebrities that said you're going to move, like, when are you going to move?
Yeah. Didn't Canada too? I think Canada was like, no, we're not going to like, just because Trump won, we're not going to let you guys in, or it wasn't going to be like some sort of special circumstance. It was like, screw you. It's
However, in the circumstance of celebrities, I'm sure they could probably figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's like, it's, and this has been a common theme just cause it's kind of what's going on in the world right now. But you know, with whether you support Trump or not, that's not really the issue. The issue is, things are so easy for us now that I think people want a Nazi, you know, they want to live in like an era which there's struggle, which there's something that
there's a defined like antagonist, basically.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, exactly. And I think maybe try to give themselves some meaning in life. I don't know.
And so that's what I was kind of touching on. It's funny you say that with the cold weather and like, you know, some people it was overwhelming and seasonal affective disorder probably affects them.
Yeah.
And for other people, it's that becomes their antagonist. And they don't need a Nazi because they're fighting the elements.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
And they go back to real life or whatever their life is and be happy because it's, you know, fighting the elements is normal.
I talked to Chris Ryan, Dr. Chris Ryan, about this, how we have a generation of people that are lacking a struggle. And you can only truly appreciate, I guess, living when you've suffered, but you know, not suffered like lost a leg in a horrible accident, but suffered, you know, had long hours, you know, did just, I guess, suffered in the non-severe sense of it or in the severe sense of it. I don't know. People.
Totally. I mean, losing a leg would be an instant and severe version of it.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of ways. I mean, in one hand, I want to agree with that and say, you know, we're not suffering as much as we used to. But on the other hand, I also want to say, we're suffering as much as ever, just in different ways.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And maybe less physical, but like, I don't feel like anyone's as happy or like, it's definitely not the happiest time in history, I wouldn't say.
Right.
I don't know.
No, you're right about that.
So the struggle becomes, I think, more internal with all the external parts of life becoming so easy. You know, we don't have to farm for ourselves, or it's easy to like, you know, find mates or sexual partners and food and all this sort of stuff. And so we just start turning inwards, I think.
Yeah.
Possibly.
And start creating our own demons.
A good struggle. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's not bad.
So that kind of leads into what we were going to say. Do we start with the Sean Hayes skate coach or the Sean Hayes backpacker in the Amazon? Which came first? If you read over your stuff, it's like you had a job, you had this, I think you were going through a bad divorce or something, and you kind of turned everything around.
Totally. Well, I'll just introduce or start it with like I started in Vancouver skateboarding as a, you know, as a passion, as something that I did. I got sponsored and traveled around, and that led me into thinking, you know, okay, this might not be something that lasts forever in my life as a career, but I really love working in sports. And I started going to school at a college up here, studying kinesiology and more sort of, kinetic ways of studying human movement.
Right.
And in that time, I suffered, this is probably like early 20s, my first couple of real bad bouts of depression.
Okay.
And it was, I mean, this was something that probably had started when I was maybe 17 or 18, but it was got to a point where I was, you know, should have been happy. I was, you know, had magazine covers in local newspaper stands that I was in, and, you know, had sponsors sending me free clothes and shoes and all sort of stuff. But I really felt isolated and disconnected from a happy life. And I went to a medical doctor, and his diagnosis was, you know, you have depression. The thing that was really hard for me at the time was how it was, don't worry, it's normal. You know, this is very normal.
Yeah.
Because it felt anything but normal. You know?
Yeah.
I hated life. And so that was the first time that I was diagnosed with depression. And that was a key part of the ongoing story. But to get back to sort of the skateboarding stuff, in Vancouver, going to school, learning about sports science, and I got a job opportunity to work in the U.S. managing a team of skateboarders called Plan B Skateboards.
Okay.
And they were they are the biggest team of skateboarders in the world. A lot of the biggest and best tricks ever done have been done by guys on that team. So okay. I took the opportunity to escape the rainy winter, the chance to California. And personally, I chose to, this was probably about a year after my diagnosis with depression, I chose to try and solve whatever this depressive part of me was naturally, meaning that I stopped taking the SSRI antidepressants and started going to, you know, acupuncture and started working with a therapist and really focused on eating better and exercising more and all the things that you can do yourself, take care of yourself.
Right.
I started when I was like sort of 23, 24, been living in California. And that got me to there in my life. And at that point, go ahead.
No, did depression affect your performance skating at all? Or were you
yeah,
still
definitely.
On top of your game there and then you were dealing with this quietly?
No. I mean, I look back at those times now and I think that if I had someone to work with to help me with the depression, I could have gone further with my career as a skateboarder and also managed the time I'd had in a less destructive way. Like, it was really challenging. It is really challenging to be a young athlete, like just kind of breaking in, not sure where you stand, not sure, you know, how good you need to be to make it or if you can make it. And in a sport like skateboarding, you know, it's not objective like a running sport or a racing sport where there's a defined finish line.
Right.
It's quite subjective. So not only are you guessing about what other people are thinking about you, but you're trying to express yourself how you think is the best way you can. And
it wasn't conducive.
Yeah, well, exactly. So it's not conducive to a person in a depressed mindset at all.
Yeah.
And I think that was a real challenge. And I just didn't have the tools to know how to manage it very well. You know, that was a classic example of times in my life where I would turn to drinking as a like self-aid, you know, like I'm feeling so shitty, but if I go get drunk with my friends, at least I'll be happy.
Right.
Whereas like, I know now that's obviously like not a path to stable happiness.
Yeah. So. And it catches up with you too.
Well, yeah, exactly too. And it's just, I mean, it's definitely not a part of it. So that was really, really challenging. And this leads into my part in the Amazon, but my whole sort of 20s in the States, I thought that just being a better version of myself, I was going to be able to escape this depression.
Right.
And, you know, I think that the way that depression is used in today's world, and I mean, you probably know a lot about this working with doctors and your physician's assistant, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
There's all kinds of scales of mental health.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Know,
and disabilities, instabilities. And for me, depression, you know, you can have a really crappy day and you can feel really down on yourself, or you can be at the point where you're in so much pain, you don't want to live anymore, you know?
Yeah.
And
I mean, severe depression, people don't understand. It's akin, if someone is diagnosed with severe depression, to me, it's akin of being diagnosed with something like lupus or ulcerative colitis, or, you know, when we hear these diagnoses, we're like, oh man, that sucks. It's a bad rap you got. But then you hear depression, it's one of those, if you don't understand it, you don't know about it, it's like, oh, that's a character issue he's got or something like that.
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's hard because sometimes it is too, right? Like sometimes it can be behavioral or circumstantial.
Yeah.
Know?
if there's, you know, if you were dealing with something at a young age and you developed poor coping mechanisms, then it starts crossing into an area that we call like a personality disorder. And
right.
That one can cause the other, and it can become a real, I don't envy psychologists or anything or psychiatrists.
It's a challenging thing. And it's really challenging when you're trying to self-diagnose yourself, not self-diagnose, but work with other doctors' diagnoses, because, you know, I don't know. I've had a lot of physical injuries, and just, you know, you can see 15 doctors and they can all have different ideas of what's going on. And just the fast moving pace of medicine, like if you stay up to date, you can be a lot further ahead than a doctor that hasn't really read anything in 10 years.
Yeah.
Regardless, I think that it was really important for me to take that step into just wanting to try and solve it on my own, because what I realized is that no matter how good I was doing, there was times, if I look back, where there would be a 6-month period where everything kind of fell apart: relationships, careers, jobs, health.
Yeah.
You know, and with classic symptoms like, you know, sleeping changes, whether it be a lot or you know, weight changes and things like this. So it was in that search that I really thought that there was a spiritual element that was missing that I could find by using the plant medicine or drug, depending on how you call it, ayahuasca.
Right.
And specifically the molecule DMT that's in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've talked about that before. And we've talked about on the show how, you know, being a person in medicine and everything, I always have to do the caveat of it is a drug. You know, we don't quite understand it as much as well as we should. So that's my disclaimer. But there is a lot of just strange evidence out there where people are recovering from severe, I guess, mental states in their life or severe mental disability in their lives by experiencing this, I don't know what you would call it, awakening of sorts while going through a DMT trip or ayahuasca trip.
Yeah. And I think that more so than a lot of other methods, it feels to me, and it seemed very natural,
right?
You know, as opposed to something else, in terms of finding personal answers.
Did you get any benefit from the SSRIs or anything like that?
Well, so on the first, I'll come to my current sort of state of all this sort of stuff when we get there. But at that time when I was taking them in the original time, is it, like I said, in my early 20s, for one, I didn't realize what I know now, which is the sort of like what's the period of time when you're adjusting to a drug, you know?
Yeah.
It takes a couple months to really sort of get to where your body's stable with them, mm-hmm. and it's actually doing something. And another thing was I wasn't doing everything I could personally, you know, in my life to be mentally happy and healthy. And sure. So it's a combination, you know, I think it's a combination of the both. But I also had a very strong view that I wanted to create my own happiness purely and autonomously, and not have to rely on like a pill, like what I referred to or thought of as a happy pill.
Right.
You know, to be able to do it myself and not have to think, fuck, I can't even be happy myself because I need this happy pill. And when I am happy, question if it was really authentic or if it was a byproduct of this medication I was taking.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. Yeah, that was challenging. That's why I stopped taking it and wanted to try and solve things on my own.
And some of those medications are really, really hard to get off of. We live in I hate to blame. I mean, the way we act in a society is the way we have developed ourselves, I guess, the way society has developed us. But we want a quick fix for everything, which is understandable because a lot of us are burning the candle on both ends. We're working hard. And then if you're going through something like that, you're like, yeah, if you can give me a pill, give it to me. You know, I got time to take a pill. But in the same sense, too many people, I think, do that. And we have too many people that are on SSRIs that really don't need it because you're gonna have those ups and downs. And they don't realize that taking that medicine, we sort of know what it's going to do. You know, we don't know what the long term, you know, effects are. And sometimes getting off the medicines are horrible. They're really hard.
And there is effects or side effects while you're on them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like I was saying, when we were just talking about the diagnosis of depression, and depression itself is people do get depressed. You know, like I was saying, that there's, you know, situational things, or, you know, you break up with your girlfriend or whatever, you're going to be sad after that. But I think the main difference that I sort of found is that when you're in that moment of so much pain that you just don't want to be alive anymore, you know, it just hurts so much. I've heard it is like your hand being on the burner. Like that, being in a sustained state of that for too many days in a row is like where I think it becomes dangerous. You know, people just get tired of that, or that feeling wears you down.
Sure.
And so that's when I think it crosses over from something that you could solve naturally to something that actually requires intervention with possibly the latest scientific intervention, which isn't that much further along than SSRI to this point.
People,
we'll get there.
You see too, I mean, obviously the suicide rate goes up during that time. And again, another thing that people kind of pass off as a weakness. And I think it takes a little bit of empathy, and it takes a little bit of understanding of the process of depression to understand that there's a difference between someone who's having a major depressive disorder who kills themselves versus the person who has the personality disorder and attempts to kill themselves. You know, doesn't really do it, but is attempting for it because of the attention or whatever. But they get lumped together. And so then you get this, oh, he's depressed. Oh, he killed himself. It was his, and it's, you can't do that. And there's a lot of disease states now where we tend to blame the person, but it's at a total lack of understanding. It's a total lack of understanding of the physiology of the human body and how it works. So,
well, that makes so much sense to me. I hate to cut you off, but
it's okay.
My own times and people, you know, when I have opened up about this sort of thing, and they're like, well, have you ever, you know, attempted suicide? And in my mind, like, there wouldn't be an attempt. It's like, I've tried, just in those times, I haven't done it yet. So,
yeah.
Like you said, yeah, I don't know if it's attention or something like that, but that would be the worst thing ever. I mean,
well, it's how I look at it is it's a fatal symptom of an often fatal disease. And it's kind of hard for people to understand that, I guess, unless you're in the field of treating it. Because once you see it enough, you say, you know, it's your brain is a very powerful tool. I mean, it's what creates your reality. And if it gets tweaked, you know, your behavior, you can't really understand. Like right now, my focus has been on treating obesity. Strictly just coincidentally, like it didn't, I never aimed for that. I always saw myself as like, I'm going to be a surgeon, or I'm going to be a emergency room and blood and everything. And then, you know, one patient, then the next patient, the people hear that I, you know, did this and that. So it kind of became my specialty on accident. And the more I learn about it, the more I realize that it's, you know, it's one of the few diseases where we name sins after it, gluttony, sloth, you know, we define it as a character flaw. But the more we learn about it, the more we realize that the actions of overeating and the actions of or the body's gaining of weight isn't the person's fault. It's actually this weird paradoxical relationship. You get fat so you eat, not you eat because you got fat. And the reason why this happens is because of our society and the way we were brought up and the foods that we were introduced, and we think we're doing the right thing, but we end up causing this mess. And I think there's a strong relationship there. There is not a relationship, but a comparison to be made to mental health issues.
No, I can see that too, because there is probably a lot of people where if they really just focused on having a daily schedule and diet and exercise program, they could do a lot for themselves. And there's people that they could do that all day long and they're not having any results.
Yeah, they're not going to have results.
They need a more specialized treatment program kind of thing. And those would be the ones that are suffering from whatever that affliction you can do.
I try to teach people to be monkeys again. That's the simple way I put it, but I don't tell people that, you know.
But I guess, but it isn't like, without sounding harsh, like in a situation like that, can a person, like, isn't it literally just, if they just didn't put so much things inside their body and they exercised more after a certain amount of time, they would have the outcome they desired?
That's the accepted understanding of it. But it's more of a, a lot of these foods out there cause spikes in insulin, and insulin is a regulator of fat. Well, it really, what insulin does is it's the key that brings sugar into your muscles, into your organs to use. When you're eating these high glycemic index foods, meaning, you eat a piece of Wonder Bread and your blood sugar jumps
up.
Your body's bolusing with insulin, right? And that's one piece of Wonder Bread. So now you got tons of insulin in your bloodstream. It can only grab, your body can only use so much in a short amount of time. And once it's bound, it has to go somewhere. Fat has a high affinity for it. So you take a kid who his whole life has been eating Wonder Bread, peanut butter and jelly. Their insulin levels are going high. Their body's not really paying attention to the insulin anymore. The fat's taking it up. You can actually, so someone getting obese, yes, the simple way is they ate too many calories, you know, whatever. But you can almost compare it to a child who overeats because his body is growing, right?
Right.
He's not overeating and the result is his body's growing. His body's growing and the result is he's overeating because he has to, right? Because he has to grow.
Is there something about certain periods in the child's growth when they're creating more fat cells or something like this, like when they're a child and when they're first growth spurt and in their puberty growth spurt?
Yeah, yeah.
More susceptible to like gaining fat cells that they'll hold on to for the rest of their lives.
I would be shocked if there wasn't a relationship there. If there wasn't a, because we're seeing type 2 diabetes in kids, which nowadays it's like, all right, yeah, whatever. But that would be the same as like, someone saying, oh, my 4-year-old has Alzheimer's. You'd be like, what? You know, that's a disease of age, right? No one had type 2 diabetes 50 years ago. No kids did.
Right.
And now it's an acceptance. And what it is insulin resistance throughout your body. So their insulin levels are so high that the fat almost becomes like a tumor. And it's just sucking up all the energy. And they have to grow, and the fat has to grow, and they have to grow. So their appetite becomes voracious.
And at a certain point, it's like everything's just wired
in
a way that takes a whole lot.
Yeah, and when I was a brand new practitioner, I'd walk into a room and be like, you know, if there was a 350-pound patient there that was saying, I'm not eating that much and I'm trying to exercise and I just keep getting fatter, I would think to myself, here's that old story again. But once you hear it enough, you start realizing, wait, no, they're telling the truth, you know.
They're suffering and they're still not getting results.
Yeah, exactly. And it may not be a curable disease. You know, it is a disease state. And at this point, it's not curable. You can do ways to, and we chatted about this in our emails recently, I sent you. We can hack that a little bit. You know, we can tap into our DNA and get certain genes to express that can almost override the system a little bit. And that's
like the most.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
I was going to say the thing I've been hearing about most or a lot lately is the ketogenic diet or variation.
Sure. Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that in terms of?
I think it's great. It's very scary. I mean, imagine going your whole life saying, you know, we're spent our whole lives not sticking metal into a outlet, right? Because we'll get shocked, right? Yeah. Well, saturated fat and fat and basically all fats were that electrical outlet you didn't want to go near. And then you start.
Totally. Okay. I'm sorry. I was getting the analogy lined up, but I'm okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're as a child, all the way up, you know not to stick a piece of metal into an outlet. Well, as a practitioner looking at the latest science and even looking at the old science, we start saying, hey, you know what? The idea that fat is the evil is actually wrong. You know, when we try to compare it to the studies where we look at what we call retrospective studies, meta-analysis, all these analysis of diets that were high in fat, we start realizing that, hey, it may not have been the fat that was causing the heart disease and causing all the issues. Most likely the high inflammatory state of diabetes or insulin resistance or sugar and all that. So it's I personally think the ketogenic and that is a good place to be. I think ketogenic is a good place to be every now and then.
Well, that's why I say variations of it. It's pretty extreme if you're really sticking to the.
Sure. Oh yeah. People drink like olive oil and heavy cream and it's pretty crazy. But the idea.
And it seems to work. Like there's people getting really great results.
From
all walks of life, from athletes to people that are having health problems and stuff.
Sure. Yeah, because it basically glucose is our main fuel, and it's like having a car, and all of a sudden someone fills it up full of diesel, right? You freak out because you're going to lose your car there. Well, our bodies are meant to use glucose, but we can also switch and use fat. And if you can prime up your body to start using fat again, you know, you'll start burning more and more percentage of fat. And you don't have the crashes. You don't have the insulin spikes. You don't have, there's a lot of benefit to it.
Well, and that's all just like the outcome of like really good science.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's, and like, it's science, yeah, and not being afraid to adjust the paradigm, you know, to,
yeah,
or paradigm. I always say paradigm, but yeah,
totally, totally. But to even to know that that would even work, you know, yeah, that that was even like a possibility is like getting down to the whatever molecular chemical level and trying to figure out, you know, yeah, okay, this with this equals that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I'd like to bring that up just because I'm thinking like, okay, so like you seem like a pretty logic based guy, right? So science, first principles and all these kind of great things. Sure. So how do you mesh that with like, with people's search for whatever they're looking for through experiences with things like DMT or, you know, meditation or consciousness? And I remember, I think you told a story about a guy that, he, I think, is a local in your town who meditates, kind of a grizzly guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Old guy that like that you would never really picture. And he was explaining, you know, reaching a sort of like higher state of consciousness.
Yeah, that's Mike Stojic. He was he used to be on the show all the time. Ex-Marine. Yeah, he's a big dude, big beard. And he meditates. And he had like an out-of-body experience. No, it's my own... I think people that don't shift in their own mindset are doing themselves a disservice. So the staunch atheist, the staunch socialist, the staunch conservative. I mean, if you're not stepping outside your boundaries and looking at right, other ways that things happen or that things occur, you're stifling your own learning experience. Even if you don't agree with it, at least you can expose yourself to it, understand it.
And totally. I mean, even you have to confirm that you're right. It would help to know all the ways that you're wrong.
Yeah, and I think a slight tangent here is I think a lot of people, they are only, you know, with social media, they're only patting themselves on the back by like-minded people, and they're afraid to step out of that comfort zone. And
totally.
And then even if it ends up justifying your beliefs, that's fine. At least you've taken that step outside of the comfort zone. So yeah, I see what you mean. I am very open-minded to a certain degree about the effects of meditation. I think meditation actually has scientifically proven benefits. Yoga. I do yoga myself now. When you're done a yoga session, your body like vibrates at an atomic level. Like I can't even describe it. It's like being high. You have this.
Better than a good shavasana.
You feel fantastic.
Better than a good shavasana. Yeah. Yeah. But I agree with you completely. And the way that you can use meditation or mindfulness practices or whichever you want to call them in high intensity, professions, careers, passions, you know, whether it be athletics or your Marine friend, or I think you said yourself when you came back from service, you were doing hourly meditations and how challenging that is to spend an hour yourself.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think that like, you know, diet, like we were just saying, that's a huge part of health. Mindfulness and mental state is a huge part of health. And that's part of what I was working on going towards the jungle, you know? And the mindfulness thing is really interesting. Like how do you, when you say meditate, what does that mean? Like what would you be doing?
Well, how I like to describe it is I want to say it without it sounding like a cliche, but existing in the moment. You know, we always, I read a book once that talked about a duck, these two ducks on the pond that got into like a duck fight. I don't know what they call it. Ducks flap their wings and get pissed off at each other.
Sure, sure.
It was like over a fish, right? And one duck flies away and the other one just goes on his business. And that duck, from the moment that it had its little kerfuffle, that little tuffle, whatever you want to call it, from the moment it ended, both of them moved on. That duck does not give a shit about what's going to happen in the next 5 minutes or that what happened 5 minutes ago. It only cares about being a duck at that moment. And right. And when I heard that, and I wish I remember where I heard that story, but it's you can apply that into your life and really I guess appreciate your existence, you know, because if you're constantly worried about the fight you just had or considering what's going to happen next, that moment, that mindful moment is gone. And life flies so quick, man. You've probably noticed it when you're busy and you're like, I gotta get this and this and this done. And then all of a sudden, like, 2 weeks goes by and you're like, are you shitting me?
Yeah, no, yeah, exactly. And taking that time out actually helps kind of slow it all down in the rest of your time, even though it takes time to do it.
Yeah.
No, I was just curious because I think it's interesting. Like, I feel like I talked to a lot of people who, they say they meditate, and I'm guilty of this too. This is like a classic way I'll meditate too. And it's like involves like going to YouTube and searching for guided meditation, somebody telling you what to do. And I think that's a great place to start, but sure. I was just curious what you were talking about. Cause I also know that there's like another level to that where you're finding that stillness and inner peace without like having to be told how to, or you're finding it on your own basically.
I think it's like, I come from martial arts and wrestling and a lot of combat sports. And I think if I could describe meditation, it is, I wouldn't even know how to describe it. You know that like that karate style where they're just kind of slowly like slapping each other around and moving things? Yeah, maybe that's it. It's Tai Chi. It's a Tai Chi sparring match with your brain, right? Because your brain is just all keyed up with all these things that are going on, and you're sitting there and it might just be focusing on your breath or it might be focusing on different yoga positions, whatever it is. And your brain is coming at you, you know, it's throwing hooks, it's throwing, and
yeah, if it, suck you in.
Yeah. And it can tag you and you can get pissed off at it. And then you're like, oh man, but it's the idea of just, you know, rolling with the punches. Another cliche.
Letting go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Letting those ripples from the duck fight.
That's right. I don't golf. I don't like golf. But people who do golf enjoy it because it's a life sport. You're always playing against yourself. I imagine skating is the same thing. You know,
personal mastery is like definitely one of the reasons I loved it is you get the opportunity to just try something again and again.
Sure. Yeah. And the same thing is I can see with meditation. I mean, there might be a few meditation masters or yoga masters out there, but even they would not admit that they, you know, they would still admit to a struggle of being able to focus and
totally.
Yeah. So it's
It's beautiful.
And I think, you know, it to kind of go back onto your like, how do I feel about DMT and everything coming from a logical medical standpoint and with meditation and stuff. I also, you know, when you look at a person, actually, you can just sit in your room and look around. Everything that you see, we're seeing at the macro level, right? So we're seeing a couch at the macro level. I'm holding this microphone at the macro level. But it's made up of atoms, right? And we know those atoms are made up of subatomic particles. And then we get down to these tiny little ass particles, quarks, and I don't know them all. I'm not a physicist or whatever. But I know there's weird particles down there. Yeah. And they snap in and out of existence. Electrons are all theoretical. They're not really there. That isn't fiction. That is not something you're not looking at. That is something that we're all made up of. Our brain is made up of empty space that's snapping in and out of existence. And when I look at things to that level, it's no wonder that folks can have metaphysical experiences or, you know, they take DMT and they have a metaphysical experience. I don't know what it's tapping into. You know, we don't know what consciousness is made of. You know, who knows? Maybe you're just tuning those subatomic particles to reverberate at a certain level and you're picking up something. I don't know. But that's...
Well, I think that there's something interesting about the, like, unknownness of it, the unknowing.
Yeah.
Sorry. Totally this part.
I get it.
There's something about the fact that you almost can't know about it, you know?
Right.
Like it's incomprehensible from our perspective, the way that some of that stuff flashes in and out of existence and how can it work. Mm-hmm. And it kind of is interesting to me that the similarities it has with sort of like theologic religions. Let me just think about this for a second.
It's all right.
No, not at all. What I'm trying to say is that the part that you're trying to describe below the like the protons and the neutrinos and all that sort of stuff, that is almost immeasurable,
right,
and tangible and really hard to describe, you know?
Yeah.
There's something else like that kind of is like the description of an ayahuasca experience, is that it's measurable and intangible and hard to describe. And it's kind of like the God that they talk about in a lot of religions, mm-hmm. Powerful and the source that holds everything together and, you know, universally connected. And I think there's something interesting in that. And that's why I was interested in your opinion. And I like that you brought it there, because that's where I think there's an interesting mesh to be discussed.
Is
God in quantum physics.
When did you decide to go to the Amazon and try? I mean, you had touched on it, but had you heard about ayahuasca? Did someone say, hey, you know, this is something that maybe you would want to consider trying?
So I was 28, I believe, and I'd been team manager for Plan D Skateboards down in the States for a couple years.
Right.
And one of the skaters on the team was Danny Way, mm-hmm. you know who he is? Gary Waltz and all.
Yeah.
So he became a good friend and someone I really looked up to, and we became quite close traveling around the world together. And he had a friend in near San Diego where we lived who, for lack of a better word, was a, you know, shaman in California.
Okay.
And he would have people over to his house and guide them in DMT ceremonies. And so Danny introduced me to this guy, and we had a session together, and it was a really eye-opening experience. And I don't even have to get it too much into the DMT experience, but it's very short.
Yeah. And was this was the smokable version of DMT. This isn't ayahuasca.
The refined, exactly. This mm-hmm. is the refined, condensed, very concentrated form of the molecule that is psychoactive when you make ayahuasca.
Right.
So in this version, you don't need very much, and it's active when it's smoked, as opposed to when you need a MAOI or whatever it's called.
Yeah, the MAOI inhibitors. Yeah, exactly. Keeps it from breaking down in your system. So yeah, you can take it without that. Okay.
But it's very quick. But there was something about it that just touched me very deeply in my soul. I want to say, you know, I was like, okay, there's something more to this. Mm-hmm. And in my intellectual mind, I thought, okay, well, you know, I don't really want to like hang out in this guy. This guy was great, but I didn't really want to hang out in his house in California to do more soul work with a, you know, crystalline, you know, condensed version of this stuff. I wanted to go where it was really natural and where these people have been using it for thousands of years. You know, as long as the story of Christ has been around, these people have figured out. When I say these people, it sounds horrible, but what I mean is these wonderful people of the Amazon.
Right.
These amazing people that have figured out that if you combine the ayahuasca vine and the branch of the kapi, it's called chacrina plant, I believe it's called, they work together to have that MAOI inhibitor effect.
Yeah, and it basically prevents an enzyme in your body from cleaving it. It stays active, psychoactive state in your body. Yeah.
So yeah, if you ate vine on its own, it wouldn't work. And so this location in Peru called Iquitos, right in the middle of the continent, basically up the Amazon River, has been a trading post for the central Amazon for 150 years. I think they've had, and there's, you know, over 100 villages use it. So there's markets there, and there's, you know, it's the world's largest city not connected by land to anywhere.
Okay. So that's, you either cool.
have to fly in or come in by boat.
Right.
And, a lot of, what do they call them? I think moto cars there. Which, you know, the motorcycle with the two-wheeled thing back there.
Yeah.
It's racing around the streets and everything. And the market there is called Bailin Market. Mm-hmm. It has, man, just everything you could ever imagine that comes from the jungle is there being sold somehow, you know, fish to crazy plants and everything. At one point, I was able to find fireworks, which made their way back to the shaman says with me, which was quite fun.
Oh, cool.
So that was where it was in Peru that I went. It was about 50 kilometers away from that little city of Iquitos, and I found this place through a friend of mine in California who had gone to this area of the Amazon and met a shaman who lived 50 kilometers away. Her name was Otilia, and I got her contact kind of through her. And it wasn't a very smooth entrance, but in the way of ayahuasca, it kind of everything worked out, and I made my way to her house without any problems.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, so, what people don't understand, and I think this is where there's a disconnect between the scientific community and the experiences of ayahuasca, is that it's labeled as a drug. But when we hear, you know, aspirin's a drug, but when we hear that, we think, okay, it's a recreational thing and people are just getting high and acting like assholes. Right. But it's not a pleasurable experience by any measure. Isn't that right? Like, you have a purging, throwing up, maybe diarrhea, vomiting. And then,
that can happen for sure.
Yeah.
And it can, you know, be spiritually and emotionally struggling, but it can also be not that bad.
Okay.
In any of those ways. And it also, I think that people tend to forget that a lot of the people I know have spent in the last year at least one night drinking enough that they felt like hungover the next day and really crappy and maybe even puked once.
Sure. Yeah.
And if you can do that, then like the ayahuasca experience isn't any worse than that, like physically. So
yeah, I'm pretty sure the death rate for ayahuasca compared to alcohol.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't think that that's a like, should ever be considered as a like, restricting factor, is that it's like really a challenging physical experience or like, you know, really hard on the body. Cause I don't know. No, I mean, I saw a lot of people, but you know, you kind of, how we were set up was in the semicircle around this room, and everyone had their little plastic bowl if they wanted to puke into it when they were sick. But I didn't really feel comfortable with that. I personally wanted to just walk outside and throw up in the bushes in the jungle.
Yeah.
And get out there. And you know, I that's what I did. So it wasn't like I was like over, like I've had much worse nights from other experiences of either being sick or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's so part of the game.
Tell me about your experience, and what effect it had on basically your life, your depression.
Well, okay. So after being what I thought was pretty successful living in Southern California, I still hadn't figured out this whole happiness thing. And I still was having times when I was completely depressed, you know, like, suicidal to the points of having thoughts of suicide or suicidal ideation, consistently enough that I was concerned for myself and wanted to figure this out so much that I thought, okay, where can I possibly work with something with my spirit? I really thought that my spirit was the part that was aching and needed help. Mm-hmm. I thought that all this pain was from, you know, because of the love I didn't have from the, you know, I just didn't connect with the world or whatever it was. You know, I thought that I needed to find these spiritual answers to life that I could bring back to my real life in, you know, my human form and thus be a happier person. So I went there with those intentions. And what I learned through all of that, I think if I was going to condense it down, was just that there was nothing more to learn that I didn't have already inside of me to learn about.
Okay.
You know, I wasn't anything exterior I needed to learn about. There wasn't more personal power I could find outside of myself. Everything that I needed to succeed and be fulfilled and happy was inside of me, and I was very blessed. I mean, I know I'm blessed. I'm a white male living in North America in 2017. Like, mm-hmm. That's a pretty fortunate, like, blessing, I think, you know.
From what I understand is that folks, and I guess it would be different for everyone. Folks have like almost a paternalistic or maybe a maternal figure that they experience, and that they can sometimes experience this guidance beyond your trip. You know, so you come back from your ayahuasca trip, and you almost have this motherly or fatherly entity, if you want to call it that, that's kind of around you. And did you experience anything like that, or was it more of a stripping of your ego?
No, I mean, see, the great thing about doing the DMT before I went there is I feel like I got to answer some of those easier questions before I got there, kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay. Yeah.
Just because, you know, the stripping of the ego kind of thing or whatever, like I, through my depressive stuff and then also like a few DMT experiences, like I'd completely opened myself up to whatever I was going to see, kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
So I was less scared about that than if I had not experienced that. But I think that what I was really conscious of, or really trying to remain aware of is how much was I being shown and how much was I projecting?
Mm-hmm.
Which was I bringing in with me, you know?
Yeah.
So like that story of the paternal and maternal energy coming with the person, you know, like is if I'd never heard that or if we'd had completely different stories, would I have actually felt that or not? And mm-hmm. And even just hearing you say that, because I've heard of versions of that, of yeah. what you'd said, maybe not said in that exact way. And my immediate thought was, well, how many maternal and paternal, you know, archetypes are there in our lives everywhere
yeah.
that we can just, oh, well, that's the like I was just thinking, oh, well, I have to eat healthier. Like the maternal version of myself is to be like super nutritious or something. That must be this spirit, motherly energy.
Right.
Or it can be, or it might not be, or it might just be a bunch of stuff that I made up in my head.
Yeah. And I guess that's a good point. We might all have this paternal and maternal instinct within ourselves and it's how we get stuff done. You know, we have our grandfatherly, sense where we say, okay, you know, you got to work hard. You got to, you know, put your, what do they say? Ear to the grindstone or something like that. And then you have your motherly part of you. It's like, all right, don't be so hard on yourself. And
yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. They're like, yeah, who's the voice that's telling you to go to bed at night?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
You got to go to bed because it's early, like compared to when you're young and you just never had that voice.
That's right. That's right. Know? Yeah. I would say it's funny how we bring that up. The biggest, who knows if I'll ever try ayahuasca or anything like that, but the biggest learning experience of my life is having two kids, because you want to talk about two egotistical. Like little kids are, it's like a reflection of yourself. It's a reflection of society. It's a reflection yeah. of, you know, how to calm yourself down. I mean, I went to seer school where they teach you how to be tortured and not give up information. Okay.
So, right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's like, yeah, that I heard a story of a fellow who's a Marine that just came back from that.
Oh, yeah.
In Washington.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. That's where yeah. I went. That's where I went.
Yeah. And no, it did not sound fun.
No, it did. Well, it was the best training I ever received. You know, yeah. hands down in my entire life, even going into PA school. I mean, that was tough, but the best training I ever received was through SEER school, bar none.
So let your listeners know before you bring it back to what you're talking about with your kids.
Yeah.
What school is.
Oh, yeah. That would be Search, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. And it's basically a school set up for if you're in a military position where you have a high chance of being captured. And they right. don't want you to, they want to teach you how to be, I guess, a good prisoner and how to, and by good prisoner, I don't mean like, you know, how to represent
your badge.
Yeah, yeah. How to represent your country well, how to keep your honor, right. but also how to survive. And it's a very, very, you know, razor fine line between those two things. And, you know, everyone has a breaking point and, you know, you got to realize. So anyways, it was just a fantastic school. It was great about learning about yourself and learning about, I guess, what you can take and how to remove yourself from a situation and kind of go inside somewhere and hang out. So I bring that up, and it's not the first time I've compared having children to SEER school, but it's, you know, you have these people that are 100% dependent on you, and they have no, their frontal cortex is still being developed. So they don't have the, you know, so bad parents are people that don't understand that their kids aren't going, they're not little adults. They just can't be. Like their brains don't work like that. You know, they don't have the filter. So, you know, sitting down with two kids who are screaming during a thunderstorm and one's sick and you know, and not losing yourself during that to kind of just roll with the punches and find okay. your happy
yeah.
zone. And
yeah, yeah, totally.
And that is, I guess that's my current ayahuasca trip because okay. I have to strip away my ego. I have to strip away my needs and desires, and I have to really, the decisions that I make around them is, I guess, how would I describe it? It's how I guess I would want to be treated in that situation. And I also have to think how developmentally that's going to, you know, what impact things are going to have with them. And that doesn't mean, you know, I'm I'm not, you know, I'm fair, but I'm also, you know, strict to a certain degree. But yeah, it's parenting has been probably the most profound trip I've ever taken in my entire life. And it sounds horrible, and I wouldn't, you know, to someone who doesn't have kids, I don't know if you have kids or anything, but to people who don't have kids that are always like, ah, there's no way I could do it. There's no way to even describe the situation.
Just realistically, think about what that age range is, though, of people that are like, oh, I have kids, like, yeah. I don't want them. Like, you know, from like 15 to like 32.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, 35. No, it is. It is.
I mean, it's not a huge scale or that big part of big a part of.
And you have to. I was riding. I used to ride bikes a lot, and I was out riding with a friend of mine, and I think I was in Maryland, and we were talking about it. And this is, I think, a very everyone faces this lesson in life where you say, you know, what decision could I have made? Because my friend was single, and he said, I don't ever want to get married and have kids. He was, you know, maybe I think he's 6 to 8 years younger than me. And I remember being in that position, but you know you have to make a choice. You know, there comes a point in life where you have to choose that or the other, and there's no wrong decision. You just have to be comfortable in what you made, and I guess accept the life that's there.
It's a very existentialist way to look at it.
Well, yeah, because I think a lot of people, I think a lot of anxiety and stuff are people's inability to be everything at once. You know. I want to be the,
okay. To wear multiple, to assume multiple roles.
Yeah. You know? I think maybe that, or saying, you know, gosh, I'm almost 30. I'm not married yet. Or, oh my gosh, I haven't settled in a career and I'm 35, or I'm 18 and I don't want to go to college. You know, we really harp down on ourselves. And, what it comes down to is that you have to make a choice, and whatever choice you make, just go with it. And then,
well, whatever choice you make will be the right one.
Yeah, it has to be. Cause if it's not, you're fine. Unless you decide to rob a store or something, then, you know,
well, no, the thing is that's, you know, and it depends where you've grown up and what you believe in and, you know, what your personal history is and the social, contracts that you've signed up for.
Yeah.
You know?
Sam Harris has a great podcast, and he talks a lot about, the lack of free will, and people reject that idea. Like it's a very knee-jerk reaction when you tell people that they most likely don't have free will. Everything that every decision they've made has been set in motion really since the Big Bang.
I can see that too. And even when you get down to like a biological point, you know, you're like, well, if you mix up all these chemicals, there's going to be this certain reaction out of it kind of thing. However, I again think that there's a part, and I probably couldn't put my finger on it, right, in what Sam Harris is saying, that he doesn't quite know what he's talking about, and it's like kind of the part that ties everything together, and it's really hard to describe. And that's kind of like what I was talking about with the connection between the quantum world and ayahuasca and God and consciousness.
Sure.
You know, I think that there's an unknown part, and it may always stay unknown, but that's the secret part.
See, that's probably why, maybe when I'm 60, I'll do ayahuasca, but I'm looking for that part, and I'm hoping to find that answer in the subconscious world, in that, you know, if I were to take ayahuasca, I want, and I know exactly what you're talking about, and we can't put words to it, but whatever that intangible is, what is that thing?
Yeah, but what if the answer is you just can't put any words to it, and that's, it's just like, just that part, it's just that special part. Like, it's just like, call it what you want.
Yeah.
Put whatever word you want on it. It just is.
That's true.
The most, you know, and it's so infinitesimal, yet so grand, and so unimportant, yet so all important. So like, it, I don't know. Even, yeah, it's an interesting thing to continue.
I'm expecting, I'm wholeheartedly expecting to get the answer when I die. If I die and it's lights out, man, I'll be pissed.
Oh, yeah. No, well, I mean, so how serious are you when you say that?
What do you mean about like, I'll be pissed if I mean, don't get the answer?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm very serious because I want to know. I'm an inquisitive person.
I don't think you will.
You don't think there's an answer at the end? You think it's just lights out?
Yeah.
It's very possible.
It's probably like a really nice sleep.
Yeah.
So you don't wake up.
Yeah. I mean, it's the way that I, So,
I mean, or it's not, but I don't think that like you'll know about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or like you still won't get the answer.
Yeah. Who was it? Louis C.K. Yeah. Someone, he's like, we're always wondering what happens after we die. He's like, a lot happens after we die. Super Bowls, birthday parties. Yeah. And it was, and then another thing that makes me think about it is, or that makes me think, oh, that could be the answer, is that, you know, try to remember what life was like back the year before you were born, you know?
That's the simplest answer for me too. It's like, I'm in as much pain about what's going to happen after I die as I am from the time before I was born.
Yeah, yeah.
None.
I want the answers. It's my personality. I love searching for the answers.
To go back to the advice that you gave your friend about the marriage thing, I think that the only answer that will ever be true that you'll find is the answer that you decide is true.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it really doesn't matter if it's the truth or not.
Yeah, that's true. If it is lights out, then, you know, who cares? You got the answer. And if it's right for you,
that's all that will really matter.
That's a fantastic way of thinking about it. I never realized that.
Well, I think that one of the best things that I didn't really talk about in that whole sort of like life story was I've done a lot of traveling, and traveling and living in other parts of the world has like given me such a different perspective on both life in general as a human species and my own personal life. Mm-hmm. I think that that's kind of an irreplaceable lesson in the understanding of the human experience, is to like not only know what your personal world's like, but what's it like in a world that doesn't know anything or care at all about Christianity, you know?
Right.
Like where they've never even talked about the seven deadly sins.
Yeah.
Because they don't even have them. They got other stuff that they are concerned about, you know?
Yeah. And then do you find similarities where you say, okay, there might be a little truth in that, you know?
I mean, yeah, exactly. And that's where you find similarities. I think that like, people want to be happy,
yeah. You know,
and they want to have freedom and like community.
I consider myself agnostic, right? And when people hear that, they say, oh my gosh, you know, you don't believe in anything and it's completely the opposite.
They think, oh my God, he's an atheist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, no, I said,
Yeah, agnostic.
For the listeners.
What's that? Say it again.
Clarify the difference between the two for our listeners.
Oh, yeah. Well, the idea of agnostic is that my idea of it, so you can find the definition just means agnostic, not knowing, okay?
Right.
But it's in the acceptance of not knowing, saying that, you know, hey, you know, that if you ever read the myth of the Bible, it's got some cool myths in it. You're like, man, that's really cool. I mean, there's cool stories.
Totally.
There's, yeah. And you can find it in the, I don't know, other sacred texts. I mean, they're out there, and it's to say to yourself that I'm not going to block out everything else. And I'm just going to follow this straight line right here. This is my, and I understand how people can go that way. You know, maybe something profound happened that they can't quite explain and it gives them peace and gives them harmony.
But easy out.
Well, I think there's a lot of, so this is a tricky
It's
subject.
Hard and challenging to accept your utter single existence in this world.
Well, not knowing to me is a comfort. I like not knowing because it makes the world a little, and I could no more assign myself a particular definition than I could using Tyler Durden's phrase, stick feathers up my ass and call myself a chicken, right? It's just not going to happen. Like,
but have you found in life though that practice of being okay with not knowing is something that's taken time to develop?
Yeah,
or like the ability to be okay with that?
I think there's a lot of guilt with it when you're younger, because accepting the idea that you don't know after growing up with everyone saying, oh, this is what you have to do.
Yeah.
And then there's fear with that. But then once you get over the fear, you're like, you know, there's nothing to be afraid of. It's just trying to understand what this is all about.
Well, and accepting that, and that then that becomes what you do know, is that you know.
And plus, it's not saying, and that's the other thing, it's not saying there's no God. It's not saying there's no Jesus. Heck, there could be. I don't know. I just haven't, you know, I haven't seen the, So, I mean, and I think if you look at the universal guidance of morals, of what is good, you know, you can get really, really deep into it, you know. You can get
deep. Well, sure. I mean, what is good for one versus the one good for all kind of thing. That gets really
like, how moral can I be sitting in a house where I have two empty rooms, talking on a cell phone that has materials that were most likely mined through some sort of labor malpractices, you know, while enjoying my overabundance of food, and I complain that like the water filter on my GE refrigerator needs to be replaced for $30 because my ice cold water that comes from this magical silver thing, right? You can kill yourself with the idea of, am I moral or not? You know,
right? Because I mean, especially when it comes to anything like that, because the truth is so simple. It's like, there's literally thousands, millions of starving children. Yeah. And like, you have children, like, and like, we're not stupid. It's not like you're like, oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, we know, but like, so we create our own morals is, I think, sort of the end point of how we can justify that.
Sure.
Sort of thing.
And it's,
you know,
it's,
and we all do that, and it's on all levels.
Yeah. Well, no. I have this guy in town here, or in my neighborhood. He's a philosopher. He's very, very well versed in philosophy. So he brings out the verbal judo, and you're like, I don't know what you just said, but I have no idea what's going on. Yeah. But I would like to have him on to discuss morals, because I think it's an interesting thing. So, you know, I have this thought experiment, which I think about all the time.
I'd love to talk.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. His name's Paul Adams. He's been on here a few times. If you just look up philosopher Paul Adams, yeah, he's pretty interesting. But you know, is it immoral to step out of your front step and there's a starving child there, suffering, starving, cold, and to step over him and go to work? Absolutely. You do that, you're a piece of shit. You're going to hell. Well,
sure. And
we know that, but we say, but that's not real because that child's fictitious. Well, I guarantee you within, who knows, you could say, it's hard to guarantee, but you know, within 50 miles, you're going to have someone kind of in that situation. And the act of not thinking about him and going to work is the same act to me as stepping over him.
Exactly. And for me, it's like on the, you know, doorstep in an analogy, or in Cambodia where, you know, I got to work and live with some amazing kids, you know, like, it's happening all over the world. Like, there's going to be like people in need, and it's for me, that's kind of sad, because it like, if we work together to have a true understanding of ourselves and our morality, I think that the standards would become more utilitarian and our lifestyles would become more simplified. But we're kind of obviously stuck in the world we're stuck in.
Yeah. Well, yeah. To be truly moral, does that mean, and I think this is an honest question, it's an extreme question, but it's an honest question, is to strip yourself of your property and be like Jesus, you know, wear sandals, give all your money away, and do everything you can from waking up to going to sleep to ease the suffering of the world.
Well, exactly. That would be one way to do it, right?
Yeah.
I heard of this doctor, I believe he was from Denmark, I want to say, and he was going to Southeast Asia on his breaks to, you know, work in the hospital and, you know, spend extra time, and maybe he took some extra time off work.
Right.
But he realized after doing it for a few years, he was actually able, if he worked through his holidays, the amount of money that he could send was able to employ X amount of doctors for X amount of hours. That was way more than if he personally had been there doing the work.
Okay.
And it was, he was actually helping more by staying at home and working more.
Right. So yeah, that's why it's not easy. It's not an easy answer.
Exactly. There's no easy answer. And I think that, like, again, it comes down to whatever choice you make.
Yeah.
You know, that's the only one that matters.
Yeah.
That's the only one that's truly important.
If everyone stripped off their clothes and walked around in robes and, you know, gave up all their personal possessions, and you wouldn't have doctors, you wouldn't have, you know, people that you wouldn't have scientists working on cures or working on clean energy sources, have
professional
or
professional athletes doing, you know, breaking records and all sorts of
right.
stuff like this.
That's right.
And so part of that, unfortunately, it's become like so, I don't know, sucked into this 1% or whatever, that it's not very well distributed.
Yeah. That's an area I haven't done much thought experiments on, because I don't understand enough about economics versus I understand competition breeds ingenuity, and I think ingenuity is very important. I mean, it's the way, without ingenuity we wouldn't be having a conversation, you know, how far away are you right now? 2,500 miles?
No, exactly.
Yeah, on a piece of plastic. Yeah, isn't that crazy? Yeah. And what's even weirder about it is right now there's people all around us listening, right? It's the most. So I mean, I understand that, but then when you start getting to, you know, the levels of, 1% versus the 99%, you hear the arguments that it's that 1% that employs the 99%, and that, you know, it's not as simple as we have all the money, you don't. Or the other way around, you know. So same thing as like the do you strip off your clothes and become Jesus, or, you know, I don't know what the answer is.
I think that if your faith is, if your faith's main character led by the example of not having many material possessions, and your job is to preach that story, that you should not have very many material possessions either.
Right. Right. Yeah. So
like, I don't know, that kind of contradiction is hard for me to digest and feel good about, I don't even have to explain what I'm talking about for you to probably know.
And this is going to sound stupid when it comes out of my mouth, but it's true. One of the more important memes, of our generation is the, first world problems, because it's hysterical, but man, does it make sense every time, you know, because I'll come home from work, you're not thinking, you complain about something, and you're like, man, that's a first world problem.
So that's down to, I believe, wants and needs.
Yeah.
You know, what are our true needs and versus our wants? And I think that's something, you know, we've kind of been dancing around the subject of philosophy, but like all our conversation has been, I think, based a bit around that, a lot of life and death type stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, our true needs are quite simple, like, you know, but our wants become more complicated.
It becomes very complicated.
You know, we may need to drink something, but like water will suffice, but we want all kinds of other drinks and water.
Yeah.
You know, comes down to the same thing with all kinds of wants and needs, you know?
Well, and therein lies the beauty of this podcast. I started it to just have the conversation, you know, even if it gets you to have your own little thought experiment in the morning. I step outside, you know, there's no starving child there, but there is, you know, you just can't see him. He could be 5,000 miles away. He could be, you know, down the street. He's there. Those are the type of things I hope to accomplish with this. And, I don't know. We'll see. Maybe
just
it does.
Do better.
What's that?
Just do better. Just do better. Yeah. I think that's all you can do.
Yeah.
You know, like, you want to help. If you really feel bad about children that need more food, then help them out. Probably within 50 miles. Said.
Yeah. I was going to say, I'm going to have to start wrapping this up because, we're getting into the wee hours on my end.
I forgot. You got East Coaster out there.
Yeah.
Are
you
protected from the,
I think so. I haven't heard much about it. We usually get just the rain from it. Last year we got hit with Matthew, not too hard, but I don't know. I haven't really paid attention to it. I always tell people this when I find politics and all that, just they're entertaining. And I don't remember if this was the last election or this election. Everyone was getting all heated and they're freaking out. And in the morning, if you open up the door and you just listen and you just hear tweeting birds and everything's good, then I'm good. If I go outside and I start hearing sirens and jackboots, and if I see a mushroom cloud, then I start paying attention. But beyond that, I only got so much brain power, and I
well, that's a good daily practice.
Yeah. I have to, or,
you should teach your kids that.
Yeah, I hope so. We'll see. They listen now, okay. But remember, they're going to be adolescents someday. And I remember how I was.
Yeah, that's why you got every morning we go outside and we listen for the birds.
That's right. That's right.
Life is good.
So any interest in coming back on the show?
Yeah, I'd love to. I'd love to talk to this philosophy guy. I got some questions that I want to ask him.
Yeah, I'll send you his...
meaning of life. That's kind of your tagline, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it kind of is. It all started with the what if was this show started with us sitting around a fire pit down the road. And it really started, it started with what if a zombie outbreak happened? And we started jokingly, you know, who would do this? Who would do that? And then we just had all these conversations like, man, I want to record these because these are good. And then, and then I just started recording them. And then I just branched out from there. And I've had some pretty interesting people on and, you know.
All right. Well, let's end it with three wait, what ifs. Rapid fire.
All right.
I'll ask you when you ask me.
All right, let's think here.
All right, you ready?
Yeah.
Wait, what if skateboarding became more popular than basketball?
You know what? It made skateboarding, if you look at the way it was back in 1976 to where it went to the X Games, I mean, it's gone a long way. I mean, look at it. Tony Hawk. He's an international superstar. And he was a skateboarding kid, right?
Well, yeah, we'll see. We'll see what goes on with that.
I think it's going to be, I mean, there's only so far things can go. I bring that up sometimes. Another thought experiment. When will the next big, you know, at one point someone was like, hey man, have you heard of this baseball thing? Yeah. These people are
right. When will the next big sport?
Yeah. Yeah. When will someone finally go, hey, check out the, and they tried to do it, with Hi-Li. Back in the 70s, they tried to make that.
Okay. So you want to make that? You want to make that your wait? What if? What if someone created?
Like what if? No, I guess my question is more like, what would be? But, see, it's tricky to label that. I would just say, what's?
Oh, wait, what if someone created a sport? What would it be?
Yeah, what would it be? Right. One that's big.
I don't know, but it's one that's big. One that's big.
You got to think.
I've always really thought, okay, I want to see this sporting event, though. It's like, you know how a lot of cities, I don't know if yours does, have like big water features in them, big lakes or somewhere.
Uh-huh.
I want to see like motocross series or like a NASCAR kind of series, but with jet skis in these water features in all the cities.
That would be cool.
So like every,
Would jet you ski have races. Teams or would it be like NASCAR?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I don't even know. I just want to see these guys in the city like flying off into the ground. Nice. So that'd be the sport I want to see. Red Bull would probably be into making that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the last, I guess it's your turn. It goes to you, right?
Okay. Wait, what if everyone was happy?
Yeah. I don't know if that would be good. You know,
it might not be good.
Yeah. Cause you need that strife. You need that struggle sometimes.
Totally.
You know, you need a little bit of suffering, and that's, you know what, this brings us full circle. Cause we started this conversation with, you know, do we need that suffering? Yeah. And, I think the answer is yes. You don't appreciate the, what do they say? The juice for the squeeze or the squeeze for the juice or something like that. There's some saying like that, but, but cool.
No, you need that antagonism, I think, sort of to give you a little something to keep you going.
So, where can folks, you have a website, but I didn't memorize it. It's
CanadianHaze.com.
Okay, and that's H-A-Y. Canadian Haze on,
it's Canadian and then H-A-Y-E-S is my last name.
Okay.
And you can find me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all sorts of other stuff with the same tagline, at Canadian Haze.
Okay.
And my book's called 5 Weeks in the Amazon. So maybe the next time I come on, I never really got to talk about much of my experience in the jungle and then the diagnosis that I accepted from the mental health practitioners once I returned.
Didn't I tell you that this is what would happen? So it typically happens. I come up with a big, this is what we should talk about. And then we don't get past the first line because that stuff happens. But, and then.
It's a big kind of topic. What's the meaning of life? I was thinking what angle am I going to take with this?
That's the best part of the show. That's why it's almost like, I hate podcasts that say they're about nothing. Never do well. That's like a recipe for disaster. But this treads that water. This treads that. This is a fine line.
Yeah, exactly. That's good.
But I try to.
Well, okay. So figure out a time, maybe when Patrick's around, and we'll get back on together.
Okay.
That was his name, eh? The philosopher?
Yeah. Paul. Yeah. Paul.
Paul. Okay, there you go.
Yeah, I'll bring Paul.
All right. Well, yeah. Good talking to you, Kevin, and we'll talk soon.
All right. Thanks, man. Take care.
All right. Thank you.
Like us on facebook.com/WWIPodcast and at WWIPodcast on Twitter. Drop us a line at waitswhatifpodcast@yahoo.com. Listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn Internet Radio. Enjoyed your listening experience. Now go forth and expand your reality.